From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Call it redistricting, call it gerrymandering.
Instead of the voters getting to pick their leaders, leaders get to pick their voters.
If you don't entirely understand what gerrymandering is, you are not alone, and we are here to help you. We'll tell you about districts in Georgia and North Carolina that might need to be redrawn. That's ahead this hour, but first, we talked a few weeks ago about the addictiveness of social media and the need to take breaks.
Every year, people do New Year's resolutions to not be on social media as much, so I think it is addictive, but you have to be able to balance it.
Here are your first thoughts. We got this tweet from Willis P. Wilson. Quote, I've been off all social media since December 10th, 2017. It's been refreshing and amazing. More time / interaction with my kids and less Trump talk. Hashtag, it's a win-win, unquote. We love to hear what you think and also get your suggestions for being happier. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or find us on Twitter at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. When I say noir, you probably get images in your head. Stark black and white movies, snap brim fedoras, guys with guns and their slinky malls. It's a dark and gritty genre where crime is king and the bad guys can get away with it.
See, Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact. At the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
There have been times when I thought I only dreamed those days.
Sue came on a bus with dreams of Hollywood, and this is how they turned out.
Keep cool, Harvey. I'm on your side.
And you can tell folks better how terrible sin is if you know from your own experience.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
Atlanta Noir is a collection of short stories with a decidedly modern and southern edge. It was edited and co-authored by Tayari Jones. This year, she joined the Georgia Authors Hall of Fame. We spoke in August. So let's talk, you addressed this a little bit in your introduction. Let's talk about the different take on noir. What have you kept from the traditional noir and what is different?
Well, when I was collecting stories for this anthology, I just said, in my view, noir, it is not cops and robbers necessarily. It doesn't have to be procedural. We don't even have to have a detective. What we need to do is to explore like the dark side of the city, a place that I wanted a story that left you uneasy about things.
It's funny because the very first story sort of addresses what you're talking about. There's no detectives. We don't even know if there's a crime. I'm trying not to do any spoilers. But it does make us uneasy about the snowstorm that occurred in Atlanta. I mean, there's definitely something that the character in this story, thought was going to be no big deal and then turned out to be quite a big deal.
And I just feel like an Atlanta snowstorm is always a big deal, right? It's 3 inches, but it feels like 3 feet. So I felt like that story was kind of showing something really specific to us in Atlanta and that kind of slightly creepy feeling.
Yeah. And that's not the only story. Again, I'm going to try really, some of these stories are quite short, so it's hard to talk about them without spoiling anything at all. But that's one of the stories where we don't, the lead character doesn't necessarily make it to safety, right? We don't get a relief at the end.
Well, noir never provides you with relief at the end. I mean, the bad guys always win. Good does not necessarily triumph over evil in noir. And I think that's why we read it, because there's a sense that you're immersing yourself in something kind of a little bit dangerous, kind of gritty, and that you're almost like putting your mind in a certain kind of danger.
Which part of noir is Southern? How does the Southern nature of these stories change the genre?
Well, in my opinion, this is why so many of the stories happen like between neighbors. Like in the traditional noir genre, a stranger comes to town and seeks help about something. But in this one, almost everyone's problem is with someone they know.
Right. There's no necessarily a mysterious figure. It's more secrets. And I was kind of surprised by the number of stories that dealt with secrets, things that people are not telling each other. Was that something you actually sought out as an editor, or did that happen organically?
No, it happened quite organically. I didn't assign the authors the kinds of stories I wanted. I gave them this broad definition. I let them choose the part of town they want to put the story in and just let them have it. But I think that we're Southerners. Secrets are what we do.
Why do you say that?
I just think if you just think about it, we are very invested in our public persona, and we believe that what happens behind closed doors should stay behind the closed door.
It's none of your business.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's kind of where some of the grittiness comes from, is that we get a peek behind the closed doors in some cases, and sometimes it's a little scary.
And, you know, and that is also part of our culture. We are aware there's a door, that it is closed, and we all want to peek behind it. We are never surprised to find out that there is a closed door, but we are often surprised at what we find behind it.
Another thing that I found sort of a common thread among many of the stories was sort of the complicated relationship with Atlanta itself, right? There were a lot of people that were either saying, I need to get out of this town for one reason or another, or people who got here and were trying to make a transition in. How did you go about organizing stories that gave a picture of the city?
Well, like I said, I asked everyone before they started writing, what part of town do you want to write about?
And geographically.
Yes. And then what do you think makes that part of town unique? Like, I wrote my story about Southwest Atlanta. I was born in Southwest Atlanta. And what I find intriguing about Southwest Atlanta is that it is a predominantly African-American, I want to say almost entirely, but area. But the diversity within that group, I mean, you have people who live in million-dollar mansions to people who live on the street, all actually inhabiting the same quadrant of the city. And I was interested in the way this bounces off one another. And that was what drove me in my story, how you have diversity amongst this group that from a glance people may not think of as diverse.
So was there a story in there that particularly surprised you when you got it back? You must have had an idea of what kind of stories you might get. Were there surprises?
I was really unsure. Writers are very unpredictable. You have no idea what they're cooking up in their minds. You think you know a person. You think they're a normal, sane, kind of chill person. And they turn in this insane story. Like the story set in Peachtree City about the girls that pick up the guy on Craigslist and all manner of things ensue. Or Sherry Joseph's story about the woman who murders her neighbor.
Yeah.
I know Sherry. She is a nice person. I looked at her like, how did you even think that up? Do we need to talk?
And her answer was?
No, I just thought it up. But I think that's the way you want to feel when you read these stories. Like, even my own story, after I finished it, I was a little startled by myself.
Did you know how your story was going to end when you began it?
Oh, I never do. I feel that for me as a writer, what makes the story suspenseful is that I, too, am in suspense. If I know the ending, you can feel me aiming for it, and then you will know the ending. But if I don't know it, you don't know it. We just walk down that road together.
How do you create suspense? One of the things that many of these stories do really well, I'm thinking of the story where he's supposed to be trafficking guns through the airport.
Oh, yes, Dallas Hudgens' story.
Yeah. So there's this, you know, from the moment it begins that this is going to be bad. Right. And you're just waiting for what's going to happen. And I, you know, many of the stories are quite good at keeping you sort of on the edge of your seat. And I wondered, how do you do that as a writer? It's kind of simpler in a movie, right? You dim the lights, you have the spooky music coming up, you have people looking around corners. How do you do that intentionally in a story?
Well, there are several ways. Once you need to get yourself a dangerous premise. Trafficking guns, that's dangerous. You are going to disguise yourself as a prostitute to meet your mega preacher father. That's dangerous, you know, so you get the dangerous situation. But then the next thing you do is simply you can just change words to make things a little darker. So instead of saying, you know, he opened the door, if he shoves the door, it has more energy. You can take just simple words and just get a one with a little bit more oomph. And it just, all those little pieces together create this sense of dread.
Did you have to pull anybody back when you were editing? Did you have to pull anything back, or I guess pump it up?
Well, you know, I have a debut author in this collection. Her name is Alicia Parker, and she wrote the story about the woman who wants to be the first lady of Atlanta who receives a mysterious package. That story is kind of wild, but it used to be wilder. It was a little wilder. And she is a mild-mannered scientist by day who wrote this, like, totally freaky story.
Yeah. So, I mean, what did you end up liking about noir, and what were kind of its, I mean, what were its biggest challenges?
Well, I was familiar with the noir series. You know, we're finally getting ours. There are over 100 cities with the noir collection. We're just getting ours. So I was excited to put us on the map because I had read the others, and I liked the way the various authors took just hometown things and rendered them unsettling.
Yeah, they're scary.
Yes, and so I was exciting, and I was excited too to look at Atlanta in a new way. I do feel like we're getting a weird rap on television lately.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, you know, now that we're the reality TV hub, I tell people I'm from Atlanta, and they have all these, like, they think they know what type of shoes I wear. You know, like, they think I wear $1,000 shoes. I'm like, I don't wear $1,000 shoes. But we've got this kind of reputation now in the media.
Do you mention that many of the Real Housewives of Atlanta aren't originally from
Atlanta? Oh, I say that all the time. I'm like, they're not even from here. But so I felt in this that while not trying to do propaganda and create an Atlanta that where everything's great, because this is noir, nothing's great, but each one of these stories is quirky in its own way. Like, we are reinventing the idea of what all Atlanta is.
What is the difference between writing, what's the different challenge between writing a short story like this, and some of them are quite brief, tight, I should say, and writing a novel? How is that challenge different?
In a novel, you've got 300 pages to get done whatever you have to do. So you can go down tangents and explore side plots. But with a short story, every scene has to be consequential to the end. A short story has to be like, if something were to happen and five sentences were to fall off the page, you should be confused. But with a novel, I mean, have you ever gotten a novel and it was printed funky and like a couple pages were missing? This has happened to me. You're all right. You can make it up. You can figure it out.
Yeah.
But in a short story, if anything is left out, it's going to upset the equilibrium because everything counts.
Is that a limitation or a benefit?
Neither one. It's really just about the way you write. Because some people who are very talented, short, tight piece, the novel confuses them. They say, why do you need all those words? I don't know. I don't get it. So I think it's just different, the way different people vibe on the page. It was hard for me because I'm primarily a novelist.
Novelist, yeah. So then can these stories be read? I know that you as an editor ordered them in a specific order, but can they be read in any order?
Well, this is what I love about short story collection. You can pick it up, open it anywhere, and read anywhere in the book. You can read it before bed. Well, I don't know if I read those
before bed. I wouldn't read those before bed.
But you can just read like a little piece, like when you're waiting in a waiting room or somewhere, and have a complete experience and put it down and come back to it, but not have that interrupted feeling you have with a novel.
That was Tayari Jones, Atlanta-based writer and editor of the short story collection Atlanta Noir. Just ahead, a trip to South Georgia to talk about its troubled past with the folks of Brooks County. But first, what is gerrymandering and why should you care? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Federal judges in North Carolina have ruled the state needs to redraw its 13 congressional districts before the 2018 midterms. They say those districts were drawn unconstitutionally in what's called gerrymandering. And that word gets thrown around a lot these days. But what does it actually mean? Let's break it down. The practice of gerrymandering started with the founding fathers of the country. Patrick Henry did not approve of the Constitution.
Give me liberty or give me death!
Henry also didn't much like James Madison because Madison wrote most of the Constitution. So just months after the Constitution was ratified, Patrick Henry convinced Virginia's legislature to gerrymander the 5th Congressional District.
All in favor?
Aye!
All opposed?
Nay.
He wanted to force Madison to run against the very popular James Monroe and then lose. But it didn't work. Madison not only won the race, but eventually became the 4th president. But the practice wasn't called gerrymandering back then because the word hadn't been invented. The word is a completely American invention, like dental floss and jazz. The word gerrymandering was first used by the Boston Gazette in March of 1812. The governor of Massachusetts at that time was Elbridge Gerry. That's Gerry with a G. The governor signed a bill that year that redrew his state's districts and helped his party win a bunch of seats in the state Senate. One of the most contorted, unnatural districts was in the Boston area, and when you looked at it on a map, it looked a little like an amphibian. So the newspaper joined the governor's last name, Gerry, with the name of the slimy creature, salamander, and a new word was born. It caught fire immediately. It was used more than 80 times in American newspapers between March and December of 1812. I think we can safely say it went viral.
It's had 200,000 views in 3 hours.
Oh my God!
Since then, gerrymandering has been a common practice. One of the most notorious examples occurred in the late 1800s. That's when Republicans used their control of Congress to create 2 states out of 1 territory.
Hi! Do you like South Dakota but don't want to see Mount Rushmore? Come to North Dakota.
The reason we have both a North and a South Dakota is that the GOP wanted 2 states that favored its party instead of 1 to gain an edge in the presidential election. The law recognizes more than 1 kind of gerrymander, though. Let me explain. There's racial and there's political. Political gerrymandering redraws districts according to party affiliation. How many Democrats? How many Republicans? Racial draws the map according to, well, race. And that can be both positive and negative.
It's artificial to talk about race and party as being completely separate.
Negative racial gerrymandering means districts were designed to split demographic groups up, so they're not the majority in any district and can't elect their candidate. The Voting Rights Act made that illegal.
It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country.
The opposite is called affirmative gerrymandering. The Voting Rights Act had a hand in this as well. Some districts were created that purposely concentrated the number of minorities in one place where their votes would have more power. Gerrymandering can be broken down into even more categories, though. Political insiders have different terms for different kinds of gerrymandering. There's cracking. That's where you spread voters around as many districts as possible so they don't have the majority anywhere. Basically, you're cracking a voting block apart. Then there's packing. This is the opposite of cracking. This is where you pack all the voters of one type in one district so they can't influence other districts. Hijacking is focused not on voters but on candidates. When you hijack, you redraw districts so that 2 incumbents in the same party have to run against each other. That way, one of them will inevitably lose, and you've eliminated a political rival.
That's the beauty of gerrymandering. Instead of the voters getting to pick their leaders, leaders get to pick their voters.
And finally, kidnapping.
They're going to take you.
Kidnapping means you take a popular legislator and move his constituents into another district. That way, you basically remove his base of support and make it very difficult for him or her to win. And listen, the law is not clear on gerrymandering at all. The Supreme Court has weighed in on the issue many times, many, many times, but has never delivered a conclusive opinion. So you can expect this most American of words, gerrymandering, to show up more and more in your newsfeed. Back in May, we talked about gerrymandering because the NAACP had filed a federal civil rights suit against the state of Georgia. It claimed 2 districts in Gwinnett County and Henry County had been drawn to disenfranchise black voters. In August, the federal appeals court in Atlanta dismissed 2 of the 3 claims in that suit, which narrowed its scope significantly. But the claim of racial gerrymandering still stands, and it has not been ruled on yet. Here's our conversation with Kennesaw State University political science professor, Kerwin Swint. Did we get everything basically right?
Hey, that was great. You could teach a class.
Well, I don't think I could, actually. I'm pretty impatient with young people. But let's we mentioned that we will constantly hear court cases on gerrymandering, and we are seeing them right now in Georgia. What is at the base of this case that's being brought by the NAACP?
The base of the case is there are two districts among 17 that were redistricted 2 years ago in 2015 by the Georgia legislature. These two districts have a composition that is very, very competitive between Republicans and Democrats. And the accusation is that the Republican majority in 2015 used race as the primary determinant for moving these Democratic voters out of a district that would more likely elect a Republican. I mean, that's the point. They're trying to move out voters that they think are going to vote against them to make that district more hospitable to, in this case, the Republican candidate. And the accusation is that they use race. Now, if they can prove that in court, you know, if you can go into court and prove that the legislature used race as the predominant factor, then you have a good chance of getting that map thrown out.
That's what happened in North Carolina.
Exactly, exactly.
And it was thrown out.
Right.
However, there are times at which the courts have allowed you to consider race when you create a district. When is it okay?
There are cases where they want to give minority voters an opportunity to elect a representative who is a minority. And so there have been cases where the courts have allowed those kinds of districts to be allowed because it's going to give minorities more voting rights.
Rather than what's called cracking these districts up to spread the voters out so they never get a majority.
Yeah, cracking is a tactic to split up the power of a vote and make it less impactful. And that's against the Voting Rights Act.
Why do we let politicians draw their own districts?
It's a tricky question because the Constitution allows the state governments to conduct elections and redraw the legislative districts after every census to make sure that the population
once every
is
10
equal.
Years.
Once every 10 years. But the wording also says after the census, as necessary. And so state legislatures use that as necessary to give them the rationale for doing it more often than just once every 10 years. And so they have been doing it in Georgia and a lot of other states, sometimes every other year, every 3 years, when they argue that the population has changed in a given district, making it unequal to the surrounding areas. And so they use that as an opportunity to redraw those lines, and gerrymandering comes into play when they redraw those lines to make it safer for their party's candidate.
Is there a way to change the system of drawing districts that might make that less likely? And look, both parties, everybody is guilty of drawing districts in a way that benefits their party and tries to consolidate power. Fair, right?
Right, absolutely.
So is there a way to remove that problem and make it less political, less partisan?
You bet. And I've been advocating this for a while. There is such a thing called an independent redistricting commission. And ideally, that would take some of the politics out of it. Not all of it, but a lot of it. There are 13 states in the country where the state legislature doesn't do the line drawing, but it's done by an independent commission charged with that authority. They then give the maps to the legislature for a vote. Those states, though, almost every one of them have been able to do that because the Constitution allows voters something called the initiative.
The state constitution.
The state constitution, right. And so voters can come together, pass a referendum without the state legislature even being involved and put the item on the ballot to be approved by the voters. We can't do that here in Georgia. Most states can't do that because we don't have that power. So it must go through the state legislature to get on the ballot. And that's the whole problem.
So have we tried in Georgia to change that? I mean, to create an independent commission and then it didn't make it through the legislature?
For over a decade, we've been trying that. First in the Purdue administration back in 2006, I was actually part of a bipartisan commission that looked at the issue and recommended an independent redistricting commission. The legislation was introduced in the state Senate. It didn't get passed. And it's been introduced almost every year since then. By legislators, Republicans and Democrats in many cases, who just see the value of an independent group instead of, as you say in your piece, the legislators choosing their own voters. That doesn't sound very democratic.
It does not. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kerwin Swint. He's a Kennesaw State University professor of political science. And we are talking about gerrymandering, especially in regard to a lawsuit brought against Georgia and the lawmakers here claiming that lawmakers violated federal voting rights law by moving black voters out of two specific districts and white voters in order to protect Republican candidates. If you have questions or comments, you know how to reach us, especially questions, because I know that this is very confusing. Our number is 404-500-9457. You can tweet us. It's at OST Talk. Now, one thing that often gets messed up in this whole discussion of gerrymandering is sometimes people don't understand the difference between voting rights in, like the case that we just saw in Cobb County, where they had to reopen registration, and the choosing of districts. How much of this is influenced by the Supreme Court changes to the Voting Rights Act?
Well, it's been a huge change because before 2013, Georgia was one of the states that had to have the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, review any changes to the legislative maps at the congressional level and the state level.
Was that deserved?
It was deserved. I mean, Georgia is a state that has a history of racial discrimination when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to civil rights. There were nine states and some localities that through the history of racial discrimination, Georgia was one of the states that had to have its changes approved by the Justice Department. Now, in 2013, the Supreme Court threw out part of the original Voting Rights Act, no longer that was the case. So Georgia no longer has to have the Justice Department review its maps. And so now it's up to the individual voting groups, the individual political parties, to bring suit in federal court if they think that a violation of the Voting Rights Act is present.
We have a question from Todd Rehm, who asks, were any states under the VRA preclearance requirement among those now using independent redistricting commissions?
Not as far as I know. Most of the independent redistricting commissions are in the western states, the upper Midwest, that have the voter initiative. The states that fell under the requirement to have their maps approved by the Justice Department normally are states where in the state constitution you don't have the initiative.
I won't ask you to comment on the legality of the lawsuit going through, but have you looked at the districts that were drawn? Do you have an opinion on whether they were drawn fairly and whether they serve voters' interests?
Well, the maps were drawn. There's one in Gwinnett County, one in Henry County. Those are the two maps that are in dispute here. And the Republican majority says that the population changes necessitated changes to the actual map. The thing is, it's very, very difficult, and this is where the federal courts have so much trouble, very, very difficult to disentangle race and party when you're looking at these districts and you're looking at changes in maps. And that's the hard part. So the litigants in this case are going to have to prove that there was a racial predominance in their decision making. It's difficult to do, but it's not impossible.
Because it's legal to draw districts and consider party.
Exactly, exactly. And so the federal courts have allowed these kinds of gerrymandering cases to stand if it's simply partisan maneuvering, Republicans or Democrats. It's only when the racial aspect comes into play that they will throw out a map. But it's possible. In Texas, a couple of months ago, a federal district court threw out a map. This is for a U.S. House district, where they were able to prove, the litigants were able to prove, that there was significant racial animosity towards Hispanics in those particular districts. And they did this through subpoenaing documents, committee statements, to show that there was a strong racial bias present. So it seems to me that's what's going to have to happen in this case if it is going to be successful. You're going to have to prove in court that the motivation was racial, not partisan.
So if, let's say that at some future date, Georgia actually ends up getting an independent redistricting commission, which is something that you are pushing for and have pushed for years. How does that then function? What's the difference between an independent commission's decision-making process and how to draw districts and the legislature's?
Well, it would take it out of the hands of the state legislators, you know, who have a vested interest in what these districts look like. And how it's usually constructed is both political parties nominate individuals to serve on this commission. And in some cases, there are independents on the commission or members of the state court on the commission. So there's a rough partisan balance on these commissions. So it's a step in the right direction. It's not going to eliminate politics from these decisions.
No, because everybody has
opinions. Everybody's a human being, they have opinions, and they're going to be representing, at least some of them are going to be representing the parties. But it's a major step in the right direction, in my opinion.
Do you think at this point, some have gone so far as to say that the way that the nation has been gerrymandered, that votes aren't free and fair anymore? Do you go that far?
I don't know if I go that far, simply because it depends on which party is in power. I mean, there are redistricting cases in Maryland, for example, where the Democratic Party has a majority, and they do the exact same thing. So, you know, the courts have looked at it as a political issue, a political battle that's waged at the ballot box. And whichever party gets a majority gets to have more influence on all the laws, including redistricting cases.
And if this case is, if the NAACP is successful in court, does that mean that they have to go back to quite literally the drawing board and start over?
That's right. If they prevail in court, then the state legislature is ordered to redraw those districts in a way that they can prove that race was not the primary factor.
Although, you know, don't get too comfortable in your district wherever you are, because as Kerwin mentioned, they seem to redraw these pretty often. That was Kennesaw State University political science professor Kerwin Swint. He was talking about the future of gerrymandering in the South. Next up, the artifacts of history from rural Georgia are beginning to disappear. First, though, we hear about Confederate monuments and Georgia's history of racial conflict. This is on Second Thought. Tomorrow, we'll devote the entire hour to Georgia's Confederate monuments. We'll discuss their meaning and significance and the values they symbolize. And we would love to hear from you. Are there Confederate monuments in your town, and what have you learned from them? Give us a call at 404-500-9457, and remember, we might feature your comment on the show. What should be done with Confederate monuments, statues, and memorials? The Atlanta History Center's president and CEO, Sheffield Hale, spoke to us about this last August.
The majority of Confederate monuments were erected between 1895 and 1930 during the height of Jim Crow segregation, and as such served as a way of affirming white supremacy. But for the longest time, it never occurred to me that the stone soldiers who backstopped the Southern landscape could retain any residual public power or be offensive to African Americans. To me, they were dead relics. The continuing controversy proved me wrong. African Americans always knew what the Civil War had been about, their freedom. When white Southerners like me talk about the Civil War in the South, we can't just talk about the 260,000 killed defending the Confederacy. That was indeed devastating. 22% of white Southern men of military age died. But if we're to be historically accurate and intellectually honest, we must simultaneously talk about the 4 million black Southerners, 42% of the South's entire population, who were freed because of Confederate defeat. History isn't something we just use to make ourselves feel better. If that were the case, we'd be talking about heritage, which I define as history without all the unpleasant parts. It is history, not heritage, that makes us take the next step. It asks us to question and consider the past and its issues deeply, both good and bad. I'm a committed grassroots preservationist. That means I believe the removal of historic objects from the landscape almost always serves to diminish us in our collective story. I do think it's much better that we keep these monuments. But if we keep them, we must transfer them from objects of veneration into historical artifacts that can tell the story of why they were erected and how they acted as vehicles to celebrate the Confederacy during Jim Crow. Confederate monuments are among our very last tangible links to that disturbing chapter in American history. Some suggest that the monuments should be removed to museums, parks, or cemeteries where they can be properly interpreted in a safe context. But I believe you cannot effectively place these monuments in context by taking them out of context. That does not work. It's better to provide context where these monuments have stood for decades so the public can understand the historic currents that led them to be erected, the history that has transpired over time, and the way that society and sensibilities have changed. This is, to be sure, an issue for local communities to decide for themselves based upon a full understanding of the topic. The decision to move, remove, or retain is inherently local. We're now presented with an opportunity to grapple with the underlying issues that have often divided us and continue to divide us. Rather than censoring the past, let's promote an understanding of its complexity. Let us look at these monuments from a different perspective, as artifacts that can help explain a difficult past. The past has much to teach us about who we are and where we are, if we let it.
That was Atlanta History Center President and CEO Sheffield Hale. For more on the center's online examples and examinations of Confederate monuments, visit gpbnews.org. Now let's go way down south to South Georgia's Wiregrass Country. An obelisk on the Brooks County Courthouse lawn commemorates Confederate soldiers. A plaque across the street marks the place four men were executed for plotting a slave rebellion in 1864. Over the next century, violence against African Americans often erupted in South Georgia. And this is where our senior editor, Don Smith, was born and raised. Don recently went back to his hometown to talk with longtime residents about how they remember the region's history and interpret its symbols. GPB's Emily Curitan reports.
The town Don Smith remembers has changed.
It used to be the pool hall. That's the general, the hotel general equipment.
One constant, though, is the stately courthouse in the center of Quitman, Georgia. A marker by the entrance honors the county's founders.
Created by act of the legislature December 11, 1858, is named for Preston Smith Brooks, zealous defender of states' rights.
Preston Brooks was a U.S. congressman, perhaps best known for severely beating Senator Charles Sumner because he spoke against slavery. Next to the sign bearing the Brooks name, an obelisk.
Our Confederate dead, erected by the Ladies Memorial Association, 1878. Looks like a headstone.
A chunk of granite is missing from the corner of the monument.
Somebody's taking a whack at that.
This is not the monument we're looking for. We're looking for a marker about four people who were hanged in front of the courthouse during the Civil War's final year. But we don't find it by the courthouse. It's not next to a gazebo on the lawn either.
You mean the one for the black, that's it over there. They wanted it over here, but they wouldn't let them put it over here, so they had to put it over there.
This is George Boston Rhines. We wait for a semi-truck loaded with pine logs to pass, and George leads us across the highway to a sign posted between the sidewalk and the curb. He pulls back a tree branch to read the text.
Civil War slave conspiracy. In August 1864, during the American Civil War, four men were executed in Brooks County, Georgia, for conspiring to plot a slave insurrection.
Over the next 70 years, mobs in Brooks County killed at least 24 people. That's more documented lynchings than in any other county in the United States during the same time period. At least 550 people were killed by mobs in Georgia between 1880 and 1930. That's all according to the Georgia Historical Society.
Right down the street, right down in there, there used to be a filling station right there. And that filling station, I can't think of the name of it, but this is the first time I had ever seen the Ku Klux Klan was right down the street, and when they marched down the street, I was a little child.
Rhines graduated in 1970 from Quitman's all-black high school. We get in his car and drive across town, where we pull up to a blue house and follow him inside to meet Owen Rice.
Not bad for a young man. Not bad. Not bad. Good to see you. Good to see you. Owen Rice. I never spell it like you meant R-I-C-E, but mine is W-R-I-C-E. Okay, all right.
The TV in the corner shows images of white supremacists marching in Boston that day. President Obama's portrait is pressed against the glass door of a china cabinet. Rice settles into his recliner.
I spent 20 years in the military. I spent 19 years and 5 months with the railroad, and I've never been anywhere that I traded for Brooks County, because the people in Brooks County are loving people. People in Brooks County are friendly people. Now, that don't mean all of them is good.
Rice says the Confederate monument in town doesn't mean a whole lot to him, but another fixture on the courthouse lawn does.
Look here. That gazebo, that's for auction off black people just like you auction off hogs and cows.
When ordinary white person look at the Brooks County courthouse, they don't see that auction block. That's what I see. I see the auction block. They can put it, you say gazebo, I don't call it gazebo. I call it the auction block, because I know that what they did there.
We weren't able to verify exactly where slaves were auctioned in Brooks County, but historians at Valdosta State University told us it would not be unusual for those auctions to be held on the courthouse grounds. Rice says he doesn't dwell on symbols of the past.
Those things, they're behind, and I try to leave them behind, Because I'm looking toward the future.
We visit another longtime resident.
Yeah, don't get me started.
Jean Logan is a founding member of the Brooks County Historical Society and Museum. She graduated from an all-white high school in 1945.
I'm 89 years old.
Logan says she does not support moving Confederate monuments.
Moving it doesn't change anything. It happened. And that's just a part of our country, part of our heritage.
She says old newspapers are one of her favorite windows to the past.
In every issue, the editors have praised the virtues of Quitman and Brooks County and have urged the citizens on to bigger and better things.
One of the most celebrated things in Brooks County, Georgia today is definitely high school football.
Straight on in, there's a sofa right there, and we'll sit down on it. When we have football games here, black folks and white folks sit elbow to elbow.
That's Coach Maurice Freeman.
Born and raised here in Brooks County, actually, and I'm the football coach here and athletic director. Graduated from Brooks County High School in 1983.
The high school was integrated by then. I asked Freeman about the demographics of the football team now.
We are 90% African-American. Yes, yes, we are. About 90% African-American. We have a few white males and a couple of Hispanic males on the team.
Freeman says recent events have sparked conversations about race in the locker room.
Those have been tough discussions.
He says the relationship between his players and local police is often strained.
They're jittery around the police. They feel like they're targeted or watched a lot more than the white male.
And when a player was arrested recently?
Next thing you know, there are quite a few people out there, around saying, hey, you're unjustly stopping this young man. Somebody called me, coach, you better get down here. So it was like 10:30 at night. I got up and went down. But they just needed a cooler head. And let's just say I had a cooler head.
Freeman believes things have gotten better than since he was a kid.
Maybe I was 14, 15 years old, and that was I liked a white female at that time. She was my next-door neighbor. We stayed out in the country. She was the only girl out there, actually. I went to the store one day, and a group of white males just, that knew that I was kind of dating her, they just took off and decided to chase me and wanted to beat me up. It was just too many of them for me to think I was going to win it, so I took off running. Just some of the words that they called me were pretty tough. I kind of had a different look at my neighbors after being called all that.
He doesn't remember exactly who chased him, but it's possible he's coached their kids.
I've coached players, and I've coached their sons. I, for one, don't think racism will ever go away.
We move on to our last stop that day in Quitman.
Well, I know Grandmother Smith is planted somewhere out here. So, my mother's parents.
The cemetery where most of Don's family is buried.
Mine. Mommy. The only problem with dredging up memories is sometime one creeps in and gets you that you weren't expecting to.
That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures of her trip to Brooks County with our senior editor, Don Smith, visit gpbnews.org. As Metro Atlanta expands, rural Georgia's population shrinks. Photographer Brian Brown is documenting the architecture of the country before it disappears. He started where he grew up, in Ben Hill County near Tifton. Now he has websites devoted to north and coastal Georgia as well. I talked to Brian last month. I got to ask you, how many miles do you put on your car every year?
15,000-20,000 at least.
That's a lot.
That's probably a conservative estimate, but yeah.
So when this began, what drew you? Did you just start taking photos of this by chance, or did you already begin with this mission of documenting disappearing sort of architecture?
Well, I did have that as my mission. A lot of places around my home that I remember from my childhood. After I lived in Atlanta for a while and came back to South Georgia, I noticed so many places disappearing, and so I felt an urgent need to get out and document those places. And I just expanded as I used up what was in my area. I began to expand out, and it's grown from there.
What was the first building you photographed?
I think probably a farmhouse or tobacco barn near my family's farm in Ben Hill County that is since lost as well. Those structures that I photographed are gone too.
They're gone.
Yes.
Did they fall or they were demolished?
They fell. They fell. Well, actually, one fell, one was demolished, yeah. And I find that with a lot of different places that I photograph. And go back a year or two later wanting to re-photograph something, I find that it's gone. So a lot of these structures in rural Georgia are disappearing. We take them for granted. We, you know, the people call them sharecropper shacks and things like that. And we've seen them our whole lives, and we pass by them on rural roads, and we just think they're always going to be there, but they're really going quickly.
What's the difference between, say, your tobacco barn that may have fallen down or been demolished and an office building in Metro Atlanta that is demolished and replaced with a parking lot? Is there a difference in terms of the purpose of documenting?
I think they're all important. It's easier for me to concentrate just on rural at this time, and that's been sort of a conundrum for me as to should I venture into more urban areas. Like Savannah is a lot easier than Atlanta, you know, to document things in. But I think any sort of things, a lot of modern architecture from the mid-20th century is being torn down as well. So there's an urgency to document some of that as well. But it, right now, like I said, it's easier for me to do rural, but I get what I can.
Well, tell me about a building that just broke your heart when it came down.
Oh, there's so many. It's that's a tough one. Well, one in particular up in central Georgia that actually had a good ending, but the courthouse in Hancock County in Sparta, Georgia, a few years ago burned. And that county was lucky enough to have the funds and to be able to get the funds to rebuild that courthouse exactly like it was before. The brick walls of the courthouse survived the fire, and they had good architects and preservationists come in and rebuild the courthouse. And I went up a year or so ago when they rededicated it, and that was actually a miracle to see that emerge from the ashes, as it were.
So but, you had a photo of the original building and then a photo of the one it was replaced with after the fire?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
I did. I was lucky to do that. And it really looks almost exactly the same. It's amazing what they did with that.
So, what, I mean, do you feel that the speed at which these buildings are disappearing is faster now?
It's a lot faster. In fact, it's overwhelming me as far as, you know, do I go here, do I go there? I get a lot of feedback from people on my websites and people telling me that, you know, this building or that building is going to be torn down any time. And it's hard to be able to go to all of them and capture all of them. But I'm doing my best.
Photographer Brian Brown. To see pictures from his project, Vanishing Georgia, visit our website, gppnews.org. And that's our show for today, but you know we love to hear from you. So we talked earlier in the show about noir stories from Atlanta. Do you have any favorite crime, dark crime stories that take place in Georgia? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook, you know that, or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.